In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking about religious pluralism in the United States, something that our guest for the program, Diana Eck, has been thinking about and studying now for, I guess, more than 20 years. She's professor of comparative religion and Indian studies at Harvard University. She's also director of something called the Pluralism Project. She has indeed been a scholar of India and its religious traditions and has written on that. She has also written about pluralism, and her most recent book is titled A New Religious America, the subtitle How a Christian Country Has Become the World's Most Religiously Diverse Nation. With the Pluralism Project, she's turned her attention to the United States and has produced a CD-ROM on Common Ground, World Religions in America. For that effort, she received a National Humanities Medal from in 1998 from President Clinton. She's also a member of the Department of Sanskrit and Indian Studies, the Committee on the Study of Religion, and the Divinity School faculty, all there at Harvard. She's visiting here on the campus, gave a talk last night, and we're pleased that she could be here, spend some time with us. Questions are always welcome. The only thing we ask is people are brief, and we ask that so that we can get as many people in as possible and keep the program moving. But anyone's welcome to join the conversation. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Thank you very much.
Great to be here, David.
Let's begin with this idea that, as you, I know you have written, that America now, today, is arguably the most religiously diverse country in the world. And I suppose if anybody would know, it should be you, since you've been really studying this for such a long time. Can you put some numbers on that and actually demonstrate how that is the case?
Well, I think the numbers are one thing, but also the span of religious traditions that are here is just amazing. I'm a student of the religious traditions of India, and you know, if anyone knows anything about India, it is tremendously religiously diverse, with Hindus and Sikhs and Muslims and Jains and Zoroastrians and even Indian Christians. The interesting thing is that all of those groups from India are now present in the United States as well, along with immigrants from East and Southeast Asia, along with immigrant communities from Africa and the Middle East, and from Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. We've got a range of religious life in the United States that's simply unparalleled. Most of it goes back to the 1965 Immigration Act, which removed the last vestiges of explicit racism from American immigration law and opened immigration to the United States from to people from all over the world.
Yeah, and particularly, I guess, one of the things that happened as a result was increased numbers of Asians coming to the United States.
Well, Asians and Latinos as well, of course. You know, it's not just the diversity of other religions, but also the new streams of Christianity that have come into the U.S. with Latino religion, the great immigration from Mexico and Central and South America.
Given the fact that we, I think, demographers tell us that we can expect the percentage of American population that is Latino, we're expecting that to continue to grow, and I guess that we would also expect that most of that those people would be Christian. Do you think that one of the things that you could say, though, is that as we continue to see that kind of diversity grow and as we continue to see more Muslims and more Buddhists and more Hindus in the United States, that probably there will still be more Christians than anything else?
Oh, yes. I think, I mean, the United States today is more than 80% Christian and, you know, a variety of lots of other religious traditions. I think there's no question that the sort of predominant numbers of Christians in America will remain. The reason in the subtitle of the book, I say how a Christian America has become the world's most religiously diverse nation. Christian there is in quotes because there are many people who still feel strongly that America is, should be, should always remain a normatively Christian country. But one of the things that we're really challenged by in this new immigration is our own constitution, our commitment to religious freedom, and our commitment to religious diversity, which comes with religious freedom. And we're challenged to make good on that promise of the freedom of religion and the non-establishment of religion that have guided this country over 200 years now and that have created a truly multi-religious America.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that you note in the book is that at the same time that we have seen this this increase in religious diversity, and we have growing numbers of Muslims. And, for example, you say that in Los Angeles, you can find about every kind of Buddhist that there is. There's an enormous Buddhist
community
there.
Incredibly interesting, complex Buddhist city. Yes.
In spite of that reality, the degree of diversity that is now present tends to take us by surprise. Particularly when people, if they're in a large enough community, if they really start looking at their neighbors, and we'll sort of put that in quotes. I don't necessarily mean the person who lives next door to them, but the people that live in their community, that they may well be surprised at how many different faiths are practiced in their community, and they might say, well, gee, I didn't know that there was a Hindu temple here. I did not know. You know, they may know that there's a mosque and they may know that there's a synagogue, but other kinds of places of worship, they might say, well, gee, I did not know that this place existed.
It is a surprising thing. There's no question about it. And part of it is that through most of the 1980s, many of the places of worship were in places that you could drive right by and not know they were there. It was a gymnasium in Oklahoma City that was one of the first Islamic centers, or that big downtown movie theater in Chicago that's transformed into a mosque and Islamic center, or a bowling alley in Hartford, Connecticut, or former U-Haul dealership in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. All of these places were not places that were visibly different. Then, you know, in the late 80s, 90s, you start getting these landmark new architectural signatures of the new America. Mm-hmm. The big mosque outside Toledo in Perrysburg that you can see from the interstate, or the great mosques of the state of Arizona or Florida or suburban Houston. So we see the recognizably different thing, and that does catch us by surprise sometimes.
Mm. Well, just a phrase like the great mosques of Arizona, so somehow that it seems a little, obviously it shouldn't, but somehow it seems a little incongruous when you think about such a thing.
Yeah, I think it's true that, you know, we're unprepared for seeing mosques that are built along the architectural lines of Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem and find them in the state of Arizona. Mm-hmm. Or the new Islamic architecture that rises at the corner of 96th and 3rd in New York, and the mosque that was designed by Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill sits a catty-corner to the corner because it's facing Mecca. And I think we are taken by surprise.
Yeah. Well, it seems that your own reaction to that at the point, and this now would have been some time back, but your own reaction to that kind of diversity, perhaps in part touched off by coming into contact with students from a lot of different backgrounds, was the reason that you went on to start this thing that is now called the Pluralism Project.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And it was because it took me by surprise. I was just teaching my world religions classes at Harvard, and suddenly about 1989, 1990, there were kids in the class who were Muslims who'd grown up in Providence and Hindus who had grown up in suburban Chicago and Buddhist kids who had grown up in Denver. And I realized that I didn't know enough about the ongoing dynamic of the history of these religious traditions in our own country. And so the Pluralism Project was really started by remapping the city of Boston and looking at the many new religious communities that had come there, the Cambodian and Vietnamese Buddhists and the Chinese Buddhists and the many mosques and the new Hindu temples. Mm-hmm. And the Jain temple out of an old Swedish Lutheran church. And I realized that this was something that was happening all across the country. So I started a project in which I sort of hired all of my students to go to their hometown over the summer and find out what the religious landscape looked like in Minneapolis or in Denver or in Salt Lake City. And then, you know, over the course of several years, we began to have a much more composite picture of the new America. We produced the CD-ROM that brought a lot of that to light, called On Common Ground, and that's published, republished now by Columbia University Press. And that includes also the history of Christianity and Judaism and Islam, ancient and modern, in the United States. There are timelines and voices and songs and calls to prayer and hymnody that present this in a kind of living way.
Maybe I should introduce again our guest with this part of Focus 580, Diana Eck. She is professor of comparative religion and Indian studies at Harvard University. She's also director of the Pluralism Project, and we've just been talking about it. She's written about Indian religion. She also has authored this book that deals with the subject that we're talking about here, that's titled A New Religious America, How a Christian, in quotes, a Christian country has become the world's most religiously diverse nation. That is out there and it's available if people want to look at it. I think it came out first in 2001.
Came out in 2001 in the spring. And then, of course, after September 11th, 2001, it was chugging along, informing many people who had not been informed before about the new religious reality of our country. And I wrote a new introduction to it for the paperback edition that came out later that year.
Yeah, it seems that certainly that is one event that recently, that is September 11th, is one event that has prompted a more interfaith dialogue, contact, some effort to appreciate, understand that diversity, to have people spend time with one another, get to know one another. Probably a lot more has happened along that line since then than was going on before. There was some of it, but probably not to the extent that's happened since September 11th of 2001.
Absolutely, David. I mean, there's been an amplification, actually, of both sides of the things that the project, the Pluralism Project, was documenting before then. An amplification on the one side of the sense of insecurity and threat and violence against Muslim communities and indeed Sikh individuals wearing the turban that sort of branded many Sikhs as distant cousins of Osama bin Laden, which they're not. But there has been an amplification of that kind of violence and indeed of hate crimes. But perhaps more important and less well documented, the amplification of these interfaith outreach efforts. Really, within a few weeks of 9/11, mosques and Islamic centers all over the country were having open houses to invite Christian and Jewish and other neighbors to come and learn about Islam in their own community so that some of those bridges could be built across the chasms of fear and of ignorance.
We have a caller. In fact, we have several getting lined up, and we'd be happy to have questions, comments from people who are listening. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We have some callers here. We have one on cell phone, so I will take that person first on line one. Hello.
Hi. I'd like to ask a question, and then I'll hang up to listen to the answer. When I went to graduate school, one year that I was there, my roommate was a member of the Baha'i religion, and I have to confess I never asked him what that was. And I know that I've been up in Evanston, and I've seen this big cathedral. I'm not sure what it's called, actually, a mosque for the Baha'i religion. Could you tell me what you know about that religion? I'd like to know. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you for that question. And, of course, there are a lot of Baha'is around to whom you can ask that, including your former roommate. But the Baha'i religion comes out of Iran with a prophet who had a new revelation. His name was Baha'u'llah. And it is part of the stream of Shi'i Islam. But there are many Muslims in Iran and elsewhere who see it as a kind of post-Quranic revelation, and therefore are uncomfortable with the Baha'is. But the Baha'is, I think, have made a point of recognizing the revelatory presence of the divine in many religious traditions. And if you go into that big Baha'i house of worship in Wilmette, or go into the great Baha'i house of worship in the form of a lotus that is built in New Delhi, India, you will see altars with scriptural wisdom from all of the different religious traditions that give some recognition to a kind of transcendent universality in religious life. And that is precisely one of the things that is very appealing to many people about the Baha'is, this recognition of the truth and the beauty, in fact, of many religious traditions. Mm.
I know that there are Baha'is in Champaign-Urbana, so if the caller or anybody else was interested in finding out more about it, I'm sure that that would be possible to do. This points at something that that you also note in your work, and I'm not meaning to single out the caller, because I think it is true of all of us, that at the same time here in America we have this great diversity of religion, at least so many different faiths represented, and some of them in quite significant numbers. Most Americans have a very high degree of religious illiteracy. That is, you know, probably you know your own faith tradition, whatever it is, but chances are you know little, if anything, about any of the others. And that I'm sure that it's true. If we walked out on the street and we just stopped people and say, well, can you tell us anything about the Baha'i faith? In case we happen to just luck on somebody who is a Baha'i, chances are most people would say, well, to be honest, no, I can't.
It's true that, you know, since the 1960s and all the Supreme Court decisions that made a distinction between the propagation of religion, which is totally illegitimate in public universities and schools, and teaching about religion, which is not only important but is integral to the teaching of history— world history, American history, Illinois history. But that distinction came out in the 1960s, so you begin to see the growth of religious studies programs and departments in universities across the country, in public universities, in state universities and colleges. But we still have not seen a sufficient enough growth of teaching world religions in high schools. And I think this accounts for a great deal of our insecurity and illiteracy. You can graduate from high school and know almost nothing about Islam, even though that is the faith and guiding faith at that of a fifth of the human race. And, you know, that's really an intolerable situation. So there are some states that have built this into their teaching curriculum by the standards that they set. California, Texas, North Carolina, Massachusetts. I'm not sure what the standards here in Illinois are. That require teaching world religions as part of social studies, part of world history, part of American history. But we still don't really have teachers trained with the confidence to do it. And this is one thing that really has to change in the next few generations, because we can't afford the degree of ignorance and illiteracy that many of us have. And it makes us feel insecure, really, in the world. And not, you know, we carry around these half-baked stereotypes about our neighbors.
Next caller here is in a nearby community, Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Good morning. I have a question. If you don't wish to answer it, please say so and I'll hang up. I cannot for the life of me understand why the administration that we have in D.C. right now does so many things to irritate other religions, mainly Muslims or Islam, period. They say things, they do things that are absolutely just irritating to these people, and they do it with amazing regularity. Is it because the administration is just so ignorant, or is it because all of us are ignorant over these religions, even though we have them in our midst? He says things that just purposely causes us problems, like using the word crusade when we're going to go invade someplace, and we are going with a Christian army, which just enforces it even more.
It's a very, very good question, and I think many people ask that question. I certainly do myself. Immediately after September 11th, of course, President Bush and others in the administration went out of their way to go to the mosque in Washington there on Massachusetts Avenue and to stand with Muslim leaders and talk in very positive ways about Islam as a religion of peace and the first Ramadan fast-breaking iftar meal was held that fall 2001 in the White House with Muslim leaders, the guests of the president. But I think what has happened since then is the sort of deterioration of that relationship, certainly in the eyes of many in the Muslim community in the United States, to the point that this last fall during Ramadan, many of the Muslim leaders declined the invitation to go to the iftar fast-breaking at the White House. And I think a part of it is the sort of takeover of what many people see as maybe the strategic emphasis of the State Department and of other brands of government, that branches of government that are not really as well-informed and sensitive to the issues of the greater part of the Muslim world as they should be. And I think we saw a good bit of that in the testimonies of people from the CIA and the FBI before the 9/11 Commission. I think it's important for all of us to recognize that the Islamic world today is not somewhere else. It's not just in other parts of the world. That Chicago is part of the Islamic world with its some 70 mosques and 500,000 Muslims. And the greater part of America with nearly 7 million Muslims today is also part of the Islamic world. We are marbled together, woven together in ways that I think we are not able to catch up with. And so we do see this tremendous disjunction between what we would like to believe about ourselves as a multi-religious nation and some of the things we do and practice in the world. And many of them do come out of a long tradition of not having enough of our emphasis on the learning of other people's language and the understanding of their cultures.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
Thanks. One of the things that I know you have observed, and I came across it in one of the articles about you that I read, or in which you were quoted, has to do with the increasing presence of religion in politics in this country, and all the observation that, in fact, you said that President Bush, has introduced religious language into politics, into his formal and informal statements, to a degree unprecedented in recent history. I think the quote was something like that.
There is, I think, if you were an evangelical Christian and understood all of the coded language that is in many of the things that the president says, coded in the sense that this is part of his speech, and he uses a lot of Christian explicitly and implicit language in ways that I think actually do a disservice to the office of the presidency. I think it's okay for someone to say, as he did in the past campaign, and when he was asked about his great his political ideals, to say, you know, as a Christian, I would like to say that Jesus Christ has been terribly important for me in shaping my attitude toward leadership and toward my vocation. But at the same time, someone who's running for public office should always say, as a candidate for president, as a candidate for public office, no matter what it is, I'm running to be president of a nation that is composed of people of all religious traditions and, in fact, includes people who deliberately choose not to be religious. Our Constitution is for everyone. And so I don't want to characterize myself as a political leader as catering only to one religious group. In fact, President Kennedy, running for president in 1960, said it so well before the Houston Ministerial Association when he was asked about his Catholic background. And he said very clearly, it's not what kind of God I believe in or what kind of church I believe in, but what kind of country I believe in that shapes my attitude toward the presidency. And that is a country in which no Catholic prelate will tell a person in public office how to think, and in which no Protestant minister will tell his or her congregation how to vote. Mm. And that is the kind of country we have to strive for, especially with the religious diversity that is ours by virtue of the gift of our Constitution.
John Kerry, who, if all goes as expected, is going to be the Democratic presidential candidate, would be the first major party candidate who is Roman Catholic since John Kennedy. And I wonder whether you think that that's likely to be. Is anybody going to take notice, first of all? Is anybody going to, when John Kennedy ran, it was indeed an issue in a lot of people's minds. I wonder at this point, have we gotten to the point where at least that, no one's even going to take any notice of that fact?
I think people may take notice of the fact in a variety of ways, and one of them is the increasing sort of boldness with which the American Catholic Church is taking stands on political and constitutional issues. Certainly the issue of civil marriage for same-sex couples is one that in the state of Massachusetts, I can attest, has been taken up with a kind of crossing the line boldness that is unprecedented in the sense of passing out postcards in services for people to send to their representatives, etc. So it depends on how all of those issues play out. But I think in terms of Carey himself being a Catholic, that's likely to be of greater concern to Catholics who don't like the stand that he's taken on many issues than it is to the large American public.
I have several callers. In fact, the lines are full, and I promise we'll get right back to them in just a second. I just want to take enough time to reintroduce our guest for anyone you might have tuned in the last 10 or 15 minutes. The guest this morning is Diana Eck. She is professor of comparative religion and Indian studies at Harvard University. She's also director of the Pluralism Project. If you're interested in reading some of her work, she has written about the religious traditions of India. One book you might look at is called Benares, City of Light. She's also written Encountering God, A Spiritual Journey from Bozeman to Benares, about the religious differences and inter-religious dialogue in a world of many faiths. And then the book that deals very specifically with this issue that here we're talking about is titled A New Religious America, How a Christian Country Has Become the World's Most Religiously Diverse Nation.
David, let me say one other thing while you're introducing me, and that is for people who want to know more about the Pluralism Project, go to our website, www.pluralism.org, very easy to remember, and you can see the demographics and the news of religious pluralism all across the country. You can click into your own state, whether it's Missouri or Illinois or Indiana, and find out what the range of mosques and Hindu temples and Sikh gurdwaras might be. Find out through our news service called Religious Diversity News what's happening.
All right, very good. Let's talk with some more people who are listening here. Oak Forest is the next caller, line number 3. Hello.
Oh, hello. Thank you very much, David, for taking my call. And let me say it's a very special treat to have Professor Eck. My question is, the three monotheistic religions of the West, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, Judaism was the first to start, yet its followers are very few in number, and it hasn't grown as Islam and Christianity have. And I was wondering if Professor Eck could help me understand why.
It's a very interesting question. Of course, both Christianity and Islam are missionizing religions, you might say. Christian mission has spread Christianity pretty much all over the world today, and the same with Islam through its commitment to dawah, to the call to Islamic faith. And the Jewish community is largely one that has continued its growth from generation to generation, by the gift of being born of a Jewish mother. Of course, there are conversions to Judaism, both through marriage and by people, and I know several of them, who have found the Jewish faith to be exactly the kind of community they want to belong to. So you can convert to Judaism, but Judaism is not a proselytizing faith in that sense. So its growth in numbers has been perhaps not very great. Its influence and its commitment and its ideals have made it extremely influential in the countries where Jewish communities live and flourish.
Does that get at your question?
Oh, yes. Thank you very much.
All right. Let's go on again. The next caller will be in Urbana in line 2. Hello.
Hello, David. I wondered if you had, anyone had mentioned to your guest, I enjoyed the program, I came in the middle, the local version of the Pluralism Project here in Champaign-Urbana.
Well, let me tell you what no one has mentioned it yet, but I did, after my lecture last night, learn about something called the Whirlwind Project.
It began in the wake of 2001, and I was happy to be associated with them. I'm a professor of music at the university. And the first year was called the Exodus Project. And it brought together in the kind of aftermath of that tragedy the Christian, Muslim, and Jewish people around a performance that we were doing of Handel's Oratorio Israel in Egypt. So that's where the Exodus Project came from. And that produced a great deal of dialogue. And I must say, I probably was one of those illiterates who a Christian, and I sing at the temple from time to time, but I didn't know much about Muslims, and I found enormously, to my surprise, there's a great deal of similarity in terms of the prophets and the people they worship and we know. And I think furthermore, and more to the point, the continuation of that in the Whirlwind Project and with Job and now meditation and maybe other topics to come, we have found increasingly our commonality in this community. And it certainly was very necessary in the wake of 9/11, but it's continued to be very healthy for the community.
I think I'm so glad that you talked about that. One of the things that's very strong about it is the fact that you began around the arts,
right,
and issues of the arts have, right, of performance and of texts and their interpretation,
right,
in these,
right,
traditions provide a place that is perhaps not as threatening to begin.
Yes.
And with the meditation, I understand you're also then reaching out to have more Buddhist and perhaps Hindu participants.
Yes.
As,
yeah,
well.
The topic, as it began, was sort of natural in the Exodus and the issue of slavery, tied in with the African American community, the Muslim community, the Jewish community very well. But as subsequent ones, as the focus changes, the clientele has broadened, if anything, which is great.
I want to say one thing about this, which is that every place I have gone in the United States, including my own hometown back in Bozeman, Montana, there is the sort of nascent beginnings of the growth of a real multi-religious, inter-religious council, inter-religious, interfaith project of some sort, much of it beginning in the years following 9/11, mm-hmm, the last 2.5 years. And I think it's extremely important to write about this, to document it, to begin to get a wider sense of what is happening in the realm of interfaith relations in the U.S. I, for one, am going to spend the next couple of years doing research on this, and I'm sure I will be back in touch with the Whirlwind Project, because these are happening literally in hundreds of communities around the country.
One quick follow-up. Do you think there was anything about 9/11 that would have qualified in Old Testament times as a prophetic event?
I don't know. You know, catastrophes of all sorts have certainly brought out the new voices that, mm-hmm, that may have been silent in ways that were not very healthy and that were part of just sort of human inertia and complacency.
Yep.
And 9/11 certainly did bring
it
those voices
did.
Out. And I think America is stronger for this in one way. Even though, you know, we're all taking off our shoes at the airports and that sort,
yeah,
of thing, I think there is a kind of undocumented strength in the fabric of American life that's come out of this. We have to, at the same time, recognize that many Muslim and other Arab American neighbors and co-citizens have, in these last couple of years, been extremely under pressure by,
yeah,
all sorts of racial profiling and,
sure,
civil rights violations,
mm-hmm,
I think we would certainly have to say,
yeah,
that has made many people more fearful and also more resentful of what's happening in the United States.
Thanks very much for the program.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's continue. And the next caller will be on our line number 4 and in Chicago. Hello.
Hello. I had a question about Islam. My understanding is that charity is a major part of that religion, and I've been looking at the indictments by the Justice Department against many people they've quote-unquote called terrorism, and it all revolves around charitable giving. And I'm wondering if perhaps one of the problems that we're having as a nation in attacking terrorism is perhaps going back to this ignorance of religion and not being able to separate what is legitimate charitable efforts or even understanding how to approach people. Because I know there was one point where the Justice Department was trying to reach out to the Islamic community saying, you know, turn in these terrorists. But I would feel if I were a Muslim, this charitable giving is certainly not terrorism. And the perhaps much of this is a misunderstanding of the Islamic religion.
Well, of course, the giving of charity in the form of what is called zakat is one of the pillars of the Islamic faith. It's an obligation, and it is an obligation in Islam as it is in Judaism and Christianity to give of one's own income and assets for charity. So this has posed a religious problem as well as a financial problem, you might say, for Muslim communities and the charities that they support. And your question is so intelligent and so right on that there are ways in which I think our government has been grasping at straws, really, in trying to respond to 9/11 and has overreached in many cases in terms of investigating and closing down Islamic charities. There may certainly have been ways in which Islamic charities funded work that reached into the wrong hands. I hasten to say that is no doubt true of Christian and Jewish charities as well. But I think the reaction has been such that, in a sense, it has begun to alienate some of the communities that we most need as our co-citizens in the period ahead.
And I guess to go back to the title of your book, How's a Christian Nation, what I'm seeing now is a problem that we've never separated religious beliefs from the state. And I think that that's going to become a greater problem because, as you spoke out about how the Catholic Church has become is very virulently speaking out against gay marriages, I think that there's no other thing that they can do because marriage is a sacrament. And maybe the question is, should the state be marrying at all? But instead, should the state only be doing civil unions and leaving the question of marriage to the various religious
nominations? These are really important questions because there is a way in which civil marriage is the foundation of marriage in this country, and it's only, you know, it's not that it's primarily a sacrament. In the eyes of the state, it's primarily a civil act that is the gateway to thousands of benefits and responsibilities as well.
Mm-hmm.
So then to describe it as a sacrament is something that Christians do, at least some Christians do. Some Christians don't see marriage as a sacrament. And if you are Wiccan, it's a hand fasting, and if you're Muslim or Hindu or Jewish or atheist, you may have other ways of describing this particular kind of union. But I think that the civil marriage issue is a very good one to be clear about what is our civic discourse and our civic responsibility and our civil rights, so to speak, as citizens, and what is our religious language. And you're quite right that these have become braided together in ways that now I think we have enough of a sort of religious diversity in our country that we need to begin to separate them and understand, separate our theological, our religious, our spiritual discourse from the kind of language that we use, the bridging discourse of our civic and public life together.
Well, the potential problem I see is the taking the oath on the Bible in courts. I'm waiting for the lawsuit about that.
Well, not everyone has to do that in
okay.
courts these days. You can raise your right hand. You can place it on the Bible if you want. There may be places where you can place it on the Quran if you wish. But certainly for people who are non-religious Americans, it has long been established you don't have to put your hand on the Bible. There are issues like the opening of public ceremonies with invocations that provide a certain opportunity for the recognition of diverse religious traditions. For example, beginning in the early 90s, there were Muslim imams who opened the daily sessions of Congress, of the Senate and the House of Representatives in Washington with Islamic prayers. And then gradually a Hindu prayer and a Jain prayer. And we see this in state houses as well. Those are sort of acknowledgments of religious diversity in a kind of public way, as was the governor of Kansas a few years ago issuing a proclamation during the month of Ramadan, or the governor of Arizona proclaiming the Buddha's birthday, or the last week, a 400th anniversary of one of the sacred events of the Sikh tradition that was acknowledged by the Michigan state legislature. These are kind of symbolic acknowledgments of our religious diversity that are important
yeah.
and that will have a significant impact in the years ahead.
Well, I feel that we're going to have some very interesting years ahead.
Yes, we certainly are.
Thank you.
All
thank
right,
you.
Thank you for the call. The next is Urbana line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I was just hoping you'd talk a little bit more about how fundamentalism is, or fundamentalists are a difficult part of the of what you've been talking about. I mean, it just seems that, and just from the just on the face of it, it would seem that if you've got inflexible doctrines, you're going to be a lot less able to commune with other people.
You're absolutely right on that. And of course, you didn't describe which kind of fundamentalists, but there are fundamentalist-type movements in virtually every religious tradition that have a kind of circumscribed doctrinal stance and have a sense of having encircled the truth within their own community, and that make them perhaps less likely candidates for interreligious dialogue with other people of other faiths. Although I will say that pluralism to me, in a religious standpoint, doesn't mean leaving your commitments at the door. It means sharing your commitments with neighbors of other faiths and having the respect to hear the mutual witness of the faith of the other that comes with that kind of dialogue and conversation. So that it's a two-way traffic that enables religious people, without necessarily saying, you know, I'm going to agree with you at all, but saying we have something that we can learn about each other from each other. Now, that is in the religious sphere. When it comes to the civic sphere, it doesn't matter whether you're a fundamentalist Christian or whomever. We live in a country in which our co-citizens have an equal right to the benefits that we have. And there was a very interesting moment that illustrates this. The first time a Hindu priest from the Shiva Vishnu temple that was in Cleveland, Ohio, was invited to open a joint session of Congress with prayer, with an invocation. It was the time of in 2000 of the visit of the Indian Prime Minister. And almost immediately, one of the very conservative Christian groups put out a protest on their website that this was taking America down the slippery slope toward moral relativism and, you know, an ethical swamp or something like that. And very soon, they were in a position where they had to withdraw that statement and say, we did not mean, even though we disagree with the tenets of the Hindu faith, we did not mean that a Hindu priest has no right to offer an invocation in the U.S. Congress. And that is the distinction between our civic and our religious life we need to keep in mind. As Americans, for my mind, I will argue with a conservative Southern Baptist who thinks that Hindus are lost and going to hell, and argue that on religious grounds. And yet, theologically, they have the right to believe whatever they want about people of other faiths. But as Americans, the insistence on the protection of the rights of Hindus and others with whom we disagree is absolutely foundational to the health and success of our republic.
As I understand it, there's a much more of a tradition in China, and I don't know if this would be the best example, but it's one example where the people might hold ideas of Confucianism and Taoism and Buddhism all at once, and that they in fact think that the play, even though some of these beliefs may be in at odds with each other, they think that the play of opposites can be used to achieve a kind of enlightened tolerance.
Well, it's a very interesting example you give, because in a sense it takes us back into history to recognize that the things we call the religions today, as if they were bordered communities, have been very dynamic through the ages and have been involved in one another's history, just as Judaism and Christianity and Islam have been involved in one another's histories and have shaped and reshaped movements within each tradition. And so it is with Taoist and Buddhist and Confucian traditions in historical periods in China, and so it is with many religious traditions in America today. Another example would be the many, many people of Jewish or Christian background who have found deep meaning in Buddhist forms of meditation and would identify themselves as really having two traditions. They're Jewish by birth and by family alliance, and they are also Buddhist by their spiritual practice. So these kinds of syncretisms and braidings are much more common in the history of religion, and I say this as someone who is an historian of religion, much more common than we would usually imagine.
We have about 5 minutes left, maybe a little bit less. I want to try and get at least one more caller. We'll go to Bloomington, Indiana, line three. Hello.
Hi. You said that religious principles should be excluded from politics. I could quote you many of our founding fathers who would disagree with you, but my protest is against secular fundamentalists who politically impose their secular religion on the rest of us by law, and then they tell us our Christianity should be excluded from the public forum.
Well, I think that's a great question, and actually I hope I'm glad you asked it, because I hope you didn't understand me to say that religious principles should be excluded from politics. I think people of all religious faith traditions in the United States are and probably should be active politically, expressing their voice in the public square. We have, you know, Muslim lobbying groups in Congress, just as we have Christian and Jewish lobbying groups in Congress, and groups that are active in trying to get their own kinds of candidates elected to public office. The thing that I feel very strongly, of course, is that that those who are elected to public office need to rise to a higher level of discourse than that is expressed in the language, the particular and, by the way, cherished language of each religious tradition. They need to be able to speak the kind of bridging language that is expressive of the best of our Constitution, which is that we do not have an established religion. It was not by accident that our Constitution does not include the word God per se, that we have no established religion, and that we have religious freedom. We have no religious test for office, so that people who have no religious faith at all are also part of the American project. And I think that has been our guiding and most sturdy rudder, and it is right there in the founding documents. When James Madison said, you know, I profess for myself the freedom to believe and embrace and practice the faith that has convinced me. And if I do that, I cannot deny that same freedom to those who have not been convinced by my faith, or who are of a different faith, you might say today. So there is a distinction here, and it's not about excluding religion from politics. It's about recognizing that our public life, finally, is the arena where each of us has to speak a kind of language that communicates to our co-citizens who may not share our religious presuppositions.
I wish we had another hour. We could easily go. And I can only give you about a minute, but I'm interested in hearing from you how this whole experience and being involved with the Pluralism Project, what sort of impact that had on your personal faith and what you think about religion.
Well, I'm a lifelong Methodist and a Christian, and my entire study of the world's religions and of most recently of studying these and being invited into homes and temples and mosques and gurdwaras across the United States has been enormously enriching. I have encountered people in communities who have welcomed me with a kind of hospitality that I think is not only fundamentally religious, but part of what is the very best of being American. And I continue to be a Christian. I say that with quite a lot of conviction, having been through this Easter season. And yet I am a pluralist Christian in the sense that I do not believe that I can encircle the truth of the one I call God within the boundaries that I profess as a Christian. If you want to know more about that, read Encountering God, A Spiritual Journey from Bozeman, where I grew up in Montana, to Benares, the holy city of India.
All right. And if you're also interested in reading more about the religious diversity subject, you can look for her book, A New Religious America, published in 2001. That's still out there. And if you're interested in the Pluralism Project, they have a website. Probably the easiest thing you do is just put in the Pluralism Project in a web browser and you'll
find it.
You'll find it. Our guest, Diana Eck, she's professor of comparative religion and Indian studies at Harvard University. Thank you very much.
Great to be here. Thank you, David.